Chapter 3. 3 years before Zola Mall was born, her parents fled Senegal. They resettled in a Johannesburg slum with their two young sons and found menial jobs scrubbing floors and digging ditches. After 2 years, they had saved enough for a boat ride. Using the services of a broker trafficker, they paid for a miserable trip to Miami aboard a Liberian freighter, along with a dozen other Senegalese. When they were safely smuggled ashore, an uncle met them and drove them to his home in Newark, New Jersey, where they lived in a two-room apartment in a building filled with other folks from Senegal, not a single one of whom held a green card. A year after they arrived in the U.S., Zola was born at Newark's University Hospital and instantly became an American citizen. While her parents worked two and three jobs, all for cash at less than minimum wage, Zola and her brothers attended school and assimilated into the community. As devout Muslims, they practiced their religion, though at an early age Zola found herself attracted to Western ways. Her father was a strict man who insisted that their native tongues of Wolof and French be replaced with English. The boys absorbed the new language and helped their parents with it at home. The family moved often around Newark, always to cramped apartments, each one slightly larger than the last, and always with other Senegalese close by. All of them lived in fear of being deported, but there was safety in numbers, or so they believed. Every knock on the door brought a brief shudder of fear. Staying out of trouble was imperative, and Zola and her brothers were taught to avoid anything that might attract the wrong kind of attention. Even though she had the right papers, she knew that her family was in jeopardy. She lived with the horror of her parents and brothers being arrested and sent back to Senegal. When she was 15, she found her first job washing dishes in a diner, for cash, of course, and not much of it. Her brothers worked too, and the entire family scrimped and saved as much as possible. When Zola wasn't working, she was studying. She breezed through high school with good grades and enrolled in a community college as a part-time student. A small scholarship allowed her to become full-time and also landed her a job in the college library. But she still washed dishes and cleaned houses with her mother and babysat children for family friends with better jobs. Her oldest brother married an American girl who was not a Muslim, and though that meant an easier route to citizenship, it caused serious friction with her parents. The brother and his new wife moved to California to start another life. At the age of 20, Zola left home and enrolled as a junior at Montclair State. She lived in a dorm with two American girls, both of whom were also on tight budgets. She chose accounting as a major because she enjoyed working with numbers and had a knack for finance. She studied hard when time allowed, but the juggling of two and sometimes three jobs often interfered with the books. Her roommates introduced her to the partying scene, and she discovered she had a knack for that, too. While she clung to the strict Muslim prohibition against alcohol, and she really didn't like the taste of any of it anyway, she was more receptive to other temptations, primarily fashion and sex. She was almost 6 feet tall, and was often told how great she looked in tight jeans. Her first boyfriend happily taught her all about sex. Her second introduced her to recreational drugs. By the end of her junior year, she silently and defiantly considered herself a non-practicing Muslim, though her parents had no clue. Her parents would soon have more serious problems. During the fall semester of her senior year, her father was arrested and jailed for 2 weeks before bail was arranged. At the time, he was working for a painting contractor, another Senegalese with proper documents. Evidently, his boss had underbid a union contractor for a job painting the interior of a large office complex in Newark. The union contractor notified Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, and reported that illegals were being used. That was serious enough, but some office supplies were allegedly missing and fingers were being pointed. Zola's father and four other undocumented workers were charged with grand larceny. He was served with a notice to appear in immigration court, along with a criminal indictment. Zola hired a lawyer who claimed to specialize in such matters, and the family forked over a retainer of $9,000, virtually all its savings. The lawyer was extremely busy and seldom returned their phone calls. With her parents and brother hiding in and around Newark, Zola was left to haggle with the lawyer. She grew to despise the man, a fast talker who liked to stretch the truth, and would have fired him had it not been for the retainer. There was no money to hire another. When he failed to appear in court, the judge kicked him off the case. Zola eventually convinced a legal aid lawyer to step in, and the indictment was dismissed. The deportation, however, was not going away. The case dragged on and became so distracting that her grades suffered. After several court appearances and hearings, she became convinced that all lawyers were either lazy or stupid, and that she could do a better job herself. She fell for the scam that easy federal money could make law school possible for everyone, and took the first bold steps that would lead to Foggy Bottom. Now, halfway through her final year of law school, she owed more money than she could imagine. Both parents and Beau, her unmarried brother, were still facing deportation, though their cases were languishing in the backlogged immigration courts. She lived on 23rd Street, in a building not quite as dilapidated as the coop, but similar in many respects. It was packed with students crammed into small, cheaply furnished flats. Early in her third year, she had met Gordon Tanner, a handsome, athletic blonde boy who lived directly across the hall. One thing quickly led to another, and they began an ill-fated affair, one that soon led to conversations about living together, to save money, of course. Gordon finally nixed the idea because Brenda, his pretty fiancée from home, loved the big city and visited often. Juggling two women proved too much for Gordy. He'd been engaged to Brenda for practically his entire life and now wanted desperately to avoid a marriage. Zola raised far different issues, and he had not convinced himself he was brave enough to run off with a black girl and never see his family and friends again. Add the strain of a soft or even non-existent job market, suffocating debt, and the prospect of flunking the bar exam, and Gordy lost control. He had been diagnosed as bipolar 5 years earlier. Meds and psychotherapy worked well, and with the exception of a frightening episode in college, his life had been pretty normal. That changed around Thanksgiving of his third year at Foggy Bottom, when he stopped taking his meds. Zola was shocked at the mood swings and finally confronted him. He admitted his condition and went back on the meds. The ups and downs leveled out for a couple of weeks. They finished exams and went home for the holidays, though neither wanted to. Gordy was determined to provoke the final fight with Brenda and blow up the wedding. Zola did not want to spend time with her family. Even with his troubles, her father would find the need to unload lectures and tirades on her sinful Western lifestyle. After a week, they were back in D.C., with Gordy still engaged, the wedding still on for May 15th. But he was off his meds and behaving erratically. For 2 days, he never left his bedroom, sleeping for hours, then sitting with his chin on his knees, staring at the dark walls. Zola came and went, uncertain about what to do. He disappeared for 3 days while sending her text messages that he was on the train to New York to interview some people. He was on the trail of a great conspiracy and had a lot of work to do. She was asleep in her apartment when he barged in at 4 in the morning, ripping off clothes and wanting sex. Later in the day, he disappeared again, chasing bad guys and digging for dirt. When he returned, he was still manic and spent hours with his laptop. He told her to stay away from his apartment because he had so much work to do. Frightened and exasperated, Zola finally went to the old red cat and talked to Todd.